Good morning and welcome to The Forum, our weekly program of conversations and issues that matter. Before we start, I'd like to ask you to take a moment to turn off your cell phone. Welcome to our spring 2008 season, when our guests will include former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, ACT's Artistic Director Carrie Perloff, nutritionist Marion Nessel, and next week, former Presiding Bishop Frank Griswold. Now please welcome our moderator, Alan Jones, and this morning's guest, Michael Pollan.
Thank you very much. It's good to see so many of you here up so early this morning. There is a kind of mysticism about scientific data, where I read recently that scientists have discovered an alarming statistic that everyone who eats carrots eventually dies. This alarming discovery may not make it past the review board of the American Journal of Medicine, but we are bombarded constantly with directives from scientists, our government, and food companies about what to eat and what not to eat. And listening to them may not be in our best interest if we even make sense of it all. There is, as you probably heard, a chair of chocolate science that the Mars Company has recently founded, and no doubt we'll get, as Michael writes in his book, nutritional claims on all our chocolate bars. Michael Pollan, a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley, where he is the director of the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism, has written eloquently about the relationship between the human, plant, and animal worlds for two decades. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, a former executive editor for Harper's Magazine, and the author of five books, including the bestsellers Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, and his most recent book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, serves as a guide through the morass of misinformation that is eating in America. His writing, I think, is all the more timely if it's true that as the 20th century was the century of physics, this century, its claim, will be the century of biology and biotechnology. So thanks, Michael, for joining us this morning.
Good to be here, Alan.
You write eloquently and there's a light touch to it. I just wanted to ask you right at the outset, are you worried? It's just a thought.
I'm very hopeful, actually. I think that, you know, well, it's kind of the best of times and the worst of times in the American food chain. There are some very troubling things going on all through, at every level. I mean, we have a public health crisis connected to food. Four of the top 10 killers of us today are diet-related diseases, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and a specific set of cancers related to diet. On the other hand, there is a growing awareness that there's something wrong with our food system and the rise of an alternative food chain, several alternative food chains. There's a great deal of ferment. It's not limited to the Bay Area either. I've been traveling all over the country, and I'm really struck by the kind of outbreak of a new politics around food and a desire on the part of people to seek out, pay more for another kind of food that will contribute both to their health and the health of the environment. So I'm very hopeful.
There's a strange question, but what do you think food is for? I say this because you say that eating should be foremost about bodily health is relatively new, and I think a destructive idea. Destructive not just of the pleasure of eating, which would be bad enough, but paradoxically of our health as well. And that is an extraordinary statement, that eating should be foremost about bodily health is relatively new and, I think, destructive.
Yeah, this is a component of what I call the ideology of nutritionism, which is a way of thinking about food that has colored how most Americans, I think, look at it, and increasingly people in other countries as well. And this seems uncontroversial to us, at the point of eating, and that we make our food choices to either advance our bodily health, food as medicine, or to screw it up because we're doing it badly. But that is the whole way to think about eating. And it's a very limited way. And if you look around the country and you look over a long period of time, you find that people have eaten for a great many reasons. Yes, we eat to stay alive, as all animals do, but beyond that basic level, people eat for pleasure, people eat for community, people eat for ritual purposes, people eat to express their identity. These are all equally legitimate reasons to eat, and health is not the only one. And a narrow obsession with health when it comes to eating, besides robbing eating of so much pleasure and ruining a great many meals, hasn't proved to be very useful. And you know, the proof is in the pudding for me. I mean, if this worked, if thinking about food in this narrow sense and thinking about nutrients as opposed to foods and thinking always about our physical health when we're eating actually made us any healthier as a people, fine. We could give up on all these other purposes of food. But it hasn't. It's been a disaster, actually.
And we've spent more on health and less on food than we used to, right?
One of the most striking pairs of statistics I've come across in the research I did for this book was this. I mean, people talk often about the fact that, yes, eating well costs more, and we should talk about the access issues at some point connected to this. But when I was a boy, in, say, 1960, the average American spent 18% of his or her income to feed themselves. And we spent 5% of national income on healthcare. Fast forward to today, and we're spending about 9% of our income on food. It's dropped by half. And 16 or 17% of our income on healthcare. So that those two, you know, lines on the graph have crossed, and that the money we're saving on healthcare, some of it, not all of it, but some of it is going to the fact that cheap food makes us sick. And wouldn't it be, you know, better from so many different perspectives to spend a little bit more money on food, to have healthier food, and a little bit less on healthcare?
And this is at the same time when there's been a tremendous scientific study of nutrition and
yeah.
We claim to know a lot more about what we're doing.
You know, one of the things you learn when you study nutrition closely and you look at what do we know about the actual links between diet and health is that we know a lot less than you would think from reading the newspaper, from reading nutrition journals. And I was struck by how much is still terra incognita when it comes to both ends of the food chain, which is to say, what's going on inside that lethal carrot you described, and what's going on inside our digestive system. And so on the side of the carrot, we found all these nutrients in there. We haven't found them all. And every time we think we found the important one, because before carrots kill you, they do confer certain health benefits and protect against cancers and things like that. So when, for example, we've extracted the beta carotene, thinking that that was the key ingredient, the active ingredient in the carrot that made people healthy, and gave it to people as a supplement, it didn't work. And in some populations, it had exactly the opposite effect, increasing the likelihood of cancer among certain populations, smokers in particular. So there is something wrong or imperfect or incomplete about our knowledge, and that foods are probably more than the chemical constituents in them. They probably are systems with various emergent properties and synergistic relations between nutrients. So we don't yet know, and the whole history of nutrition is one overlooked nutrient after another.
So there might be something about a carrot that's more than the sum of its parts.
Exactly. Foods are probably, and we have good reason to believe, there have been some tests in the case of whole grains that suggest that foods are more than the sum of their nutrient parts, and to try to break them down, as reductive science needs to do in order to perform its experiments. I mean, there's a reason that we look at food this way, that begins with science's need to isolate individual variables that can then be tested. And it's very hard to perform trials on carrots. So, you know, in general, studying complex systems is very, very difficult. And so the way I look at it is nutrition science is, you know, very interesting, very promising. Someday they may figure this all out. But it's kind of where surgery was in 1650, you know, which is to say, interesting, promising, but are you ready to get on the table?
Right.
I'm not so sure.
Well, I have to say I've been particularly interested in nutrition, partly because I was part of a scientific study with prostate cancer. So I felt I was sort of beginning to be pretty knowledgeable, a little more knowledgeable than the general population. But when I read your book, I feel I've got it all wrong. So I want you to tell me about fats.
Well, fats are one of the most controversial areas of nutrition science. You know, the whole history of nutrition in America has been, like any ideology, nutritionism divides the world into good and evil. So at any moment, there
is... It's a very Manichaean...
Very Manichaean, yes. Right. And so at any given moment, there is the satanic nutrient that we are trying to drive from the food supply. And then there is the savior nutrient that is going to, as long as we get enough of that, we will, you know, live long, healthy lives. In fact, we'll live forever. So fat, for most of our lifetimes, has been the great dietary evil, saturated fats in particular. And there was this lipid hypothesis that was advanced beginning in the 50s, but it didn't really come to public notice till the 70s, that suggested that most of our health problems related to food, and this included cancer, and this included heart disease and obesity, were related to fat in the diet. And if we could just remove this, we would be fine. As time has gone on, it appears that this hypothesis is deeply flawed. First, you can't generalize about fats. There are many fats that are critically important to our health. And that fat is partly demonized because it's an unfortunate name for this particular nutrient, since it's the same name for this condition we don't like aesthetically on our body. If we called it lipids or something else...
Lipids is just a fancy name for fat?
Yeah, lipids are a fancy name for fats. But it would allow us to think a little more clearly, I think, about fats. And we would learn that, in fact, you need fats. You need a lot of fats. Your brain is 60 or 70% fats. And if you don't have enough fats, your brain's not going to function very well. You need omega-3 fatty acids, for example. Very, very important, we're learning, and deficient in the American diet. And too many of other kinds of fats are bad for you. The big problem with the lipid hypothesis, though, and its focus on saturated fats and its elevation as the blessed fat back then, the polyunsaturated fatty acids, I hope I'm not getting too technical for you, is that it encouraged us to believe that if we would just move from vegetable-based fats off of meat-based fats,
right,
everything would be well. So we were told to eat margarine. Now, margarine was made by taking vegetable oils and kind of shooting them through with hydrogenating them so that they would be solid and stable at room temperature. This had a couple effects. One was it drove the omega-3s out of this material because omega-3s were the most perishable fats. So we have deliberately eliminated probably the most critical fat from our diet on purpose without realizing what we were doing. And second, we created these things called trans fats. So we, in our quest to drive a possibly mildly unhealthy fat called saturated fat, I'm not even prepared to say it is lethal, out of our diet, we moved the population onto a now demonstrably lethal fat called trans fat. This was a public health disaster. I mean, trans fats cause about 100,000 cases of heart disease a year, or deaths from heart disease a year. And it seems to me we're owed an apology for this. I mean, this was a huge mistake, and it should be investigated.
Yes. And
but the nutritionists just go on with their new theories as if nothing had happened in the past, and we should believe them now as we believe them then.
It's that sort of almost blind faith in
science.
In science.
Yeah, I think we're...
It's bad enough in religion, but when you get it in science... science is much harder stuff, I think.
Well, you know, we, in all matters having to do, at least with biology, we you know, automatically credit science as the most authoritative source of information. And in many matters, that is true. But in matters of food, so far, culture, historically, has been a more reliable guide to what to eat than science.
Right. You say that just as you were writing this book, the FDA has just signed off on a new health claim for Frito-Lay chips. Oh, yes.
Didn't you know they were health food?
It's a health food. So, this is quoting you, so can a notorious junk food pass through the needle eye of a nutritionist's logic and come out on the other side looking like a health food. Which brings me to, I think, a very tricky thing, because we won't like to think of pure science, and scientists are terrific, responsible people working hard, but there is the politics of all this.
Mm.
And I wondered where you are. I mean, the farm bill, what does the farm bill have to do with how we eat in this country? And why is it important?
Before I talk about the farm bill, I always like to have the door locked so people don't flee, because it's a potentially, some people, when they hear that word, they run for the exits. Mm. Well, we've had a very interesting experience around the farm bill this year, and very exciting new politics around the farm bill. The farm bill has a lot to do with the shape of our food system and the choices available to us. The farm bill is the reason that the cheapest calories in the supermarket are the least healthy calories, which is to say added fat, added sugar, all basically the processed food calories that we have a problem with are the calories that we subsidize heavily. We encourage our farmers to grow lots of corn and soybeans. And those are the building blocks of fast food. The soy becomes hydrogenated oils, which now constitute 20% of the average American's diet, that one food, that one unhealthy food. And then on the other side, plus the soy is used to feed cattle, it's their source of protein. And it's used in, I think, 70% of processed foods have some soy in them. And then on the other hand, the corn, which we heavily subsidize as well, and grow immense quantities of in a great monoculture that is, you know, expanding now with ethanol and taking over the Middle West and other parts of the country. Corn is turned into high fructose corn syrup. Corn is turned into feed for cheap feedlot meat. Corn is turned into any number of the obscure chemicals on the side of a package of chicken nuggets or Twinkies. I mean, that's all corn-based chemistry. So it's no wonder that if you're on a limited budget, let's say you're a food stamps recipient and you're getting your $65 a week to feed a family of four, so you're walking into the supermarket with a very limited amount of money and you need to buy enough calories to get your family through the week, you will gravitate to the least healthy food in the store, because it is in the processed food aisles where you can get 1,250 calories for every dollar. But if you take that dollar to the produce section, you can only get 250 calories of carrots or broccoli. So we've set up the rules of the game in such a way that we're essentially, and this wasn't the intent of the farm bill, but, and there's a history of why we ended up this way, where we're subsidizing precisely the food we shouldn't be eating. And we are not doing anything for the people growing fresh produce. And so it's no wonder that that these diseases we talk about, you know, the biggest predictor for obesity, diabetes, heart disease, is social class. Mm-hmm. The less money you have, the more likely you are to suffer from these diseases. And the reason is that the food you have the most access to and can afford most easily are the cheap, very unhealthy calories.
Cheap, but unhealthy calories.
Exactly. So the answer to, I mean, all of us, or many of us, who can afford to spend a little bit more for healthier food and should, fine, but we can vote with our forks. But for a whole lot of other people, we're going to have to change the policies, the rules of the game. And most of those rules are enshrined in this farm bill, and specifically in this commodity title, which is where all these subsidies go on. And to recap what happened this year, we had a great deal of activism and ferment around getting the system changed. And in the end, the powers that be, which is to say the farm state legislators who write the farm bill in consultation with their corporate backers such as ADM and Cargill and Pepsi-Cola and McDonald's, preserved all the subsidies intact. They were not touched
at all.
Not touched at all. What did come out of it, and that was very discouraging, certainly, and Nancy Pelosi played a very important role in leaving the farm bill intact. Our senators, responding to the unprecedented amount of mail and calls and letters, did move their position and did vote for some very, I think, progressive amendments. So that was good. I think progress was made there. But Nancy Pelosi did not vote with the interests of children, of public health, all her traditional issues. She voted with the interest of her agricultural committee. The good thing that came out of the Farm Bill was that in order to preserve these subsidies in the face of all this political activism for change, that they had to do what they've historically done, which is buy off their critics. In the same way that the farm state legislators support money for food stamps to cobble together a coalition, because there are only so many farm state legislators. They need some urban legislators to get through the Farm Bill. And traditionally they've done it by buying people off with food stamps. They bought the critics off with lots of other goodies. So for the first time, and it's not, none of this is finished. There's a conference committee going on now, and we all still need to pay attention to what's happening, because very often conference committees are very obscure rituals on Capitol Hill, where very often good things get stripped out of bills mysteriously and nobody knows what happened. And there's a lot of pressure now to shrink some of the good things in this bill. But there was money for the first time for specialty crops, which is Farm Bill speak for actual food, you know, crops that you can eat, like carrots and broccoli, and the things that are grown in California. So to buy off the California delegation, there was money for specialty crops, which is a good thing. And this is money, not subsidies, but to promote the consumption of fruits and vegetables. Very good thing. There is money to make it easier for schools to buy food from local farmers. They used to have to buy from the least cost supplier, which was never the local farmer. Now they don't. There is money for organic research and conversion to organics. You know, not lots of money, but small pilot programs that can lead to important changes, and a lot of money to promote local farmers markets and things like that. So things were gained. There's no question. And that I think that the critics of the bill proved their power, and especially on some of these amendments that did get 40 votes to really throw out the whole commodity title. And I think we just have to redouble our efforts. And in 5 years, that's when the Farm Bill comes up again, make sure we get a food bill, because we're still getting farm bills. These are bills designed for farmers and the people who buy their food, the processors. But we really need to convince everybody to realize this is a food bill. It affects eaters, and that eaters should have a voice in how it gets written.
It strikes me, I mean, and there's a leitmotif in your book, in books, I think, about food which has something to do with the commonwealth, has something to do with a common humanity, which therefore introduces issues of spirituality, the vision that we don't live up to as much as we'd like to here, that we are one people gathered around one table where there's enough food for everybody. That this inevitably makes spirituality and politics come together. And I think that is the underlying revolution in much of what you're writing about.
Well, you know, what has happened to food over the last 100 years has been a shrinking of the vision of everything food is. I mean, partly to this health question, partly to this idea that it's fuel, that it should be fast, cheap, and easy. But if you look historically at what food has meant, it has been sacred. It is a means through which we commune with one another and with nature. It is our most profound engagement with the natural world. You know, animals feed, humans dine. We've made of eating a social experience until snacking and eating in the cars took over.
And we get our food from the same place we get our gas, you're saying.
Well, yeah, increasingly. One of my tips in the back of this book is don't get your fuel from the same place your car does, because there's a lot of food now being sold in gas stations. They make more money on the food than they do on the gas now. But look at what that food is. So you've got high fructose corn syrup for you inside and ethanol for your car outside. You're both eating corn.
That's right.
So I think one of my goals in this book is to help recover some of these other meanings of food. And because I have found, as I've learned about that, and I've learned a lot more about it since I moved out to California, that food can still do for us what it did for humans thousands of years ago. It can still connect us to the natural world. It can still connect us to one another. It hasn't lost any of that potential.
Right, right. There is this sense of the Bay Area. I mean, there's two sides. My Manichaean thing here. The Bay Area can be considered a food mecca, especially with the long-standing local champions of sustainable and organic eating, Alice Waters of Chez Panisse, and others, and as a fairly recent East Coast transplant yourself, would you say that we are ahead of the crowd out here, better eaters, better citizens as opposed to consumers, or, as you say, suggest, are we a hotbed of orthorexics, soon to be acknowledged as the newest eating disorder?
Well, yeah, orthorexia, it's not my coinage. A shrink came up with this. He was seeing a lot of patients with an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. So we must guard against falling into that eating disorder. You know, in the Bay Area, in many ways, the food culture is ahead of where it is in other parts of the country. Although I have been very powerfully struck by how much is going on in places that would seem really unpromising in terms of climate. I mean, we have the advantage of farmers markets that are open all year round. I mean, that is stunning and very unusual. I mean, you know, in New Haven, I was invited to throw out the first head of lettuce, a ceremony they have every year when they start their farmers market, but it doesn't happen until like May 1st. Right. So nothing till May 1st. So we are lucky, and I think that we, the pleasure of food, I mean, it has been a place where we do not overlook the pleasure of food. I don't think we eat strictly for health out here. I think that pleasure's been an important part of it. And this is a place that understands that the personal is political, and food is one of those issues where the personal is political. So there's a lot, you know, people in the Bay Area, people like Alice Waters, have had a lot to do with driving this revolution nationally and setting taste. And it's no accident that when the New York Times wants to hire, you know, a really first-rate reporter to cover food, they look to the San Francisco Chronicle, Kim Severson, who moved out to New York. They don't do that in other subjects, by and large. But in food, it's very well understood that this is where a lot of it is happening.
Before we open it up, I want to ask you, come back to this issue of bad science and how we resist it, the different aspects of bad science. You talk about parking lot science, for example. Mm. Well, can you explain that? What is parking lot science?
Parking lot science is a term used for, you know, the classic story of the... When you study what you can see, so for example, the science of cardiology has obsessed about cholesterol for most of its history. Why was that? Well, it was because it was the only factor in the blood that we could correlate with heart attacks. So we decided it was the cause, and then we started focusing on cholesterol in the diet, and we had this kind of single-minded focus on this one parameter. And this is parking lot science in the sense that, you know, the famous story of the man who loses his keys in the parking lot, and he looks for them under the light, even though he knows that's not where they are. And someone says, well, why are you looking there if they're over there? He said, well, this is the only place I can see.
That's
true for our obsession with cholesterol, which, you know, if you read the news this week, we're suddenly learning that you can lower cholesterol and not lower the incidence of heart disease with this drug, Zetia. And now we're C-reactive homocysteines and C-reactive protein and all these other factors for heart disease. So, you know, one of the lessons, and what I'm saying, I don't think, offends scientists as much as those of us who have faith in science. Scientists are much more aware of what they don't know than people like us who report on science. And that the fact that science is imperfect and incremental and, you know, advances hypotheses all the time that get shot down in the course of things, this is how it's supposed to work. I think that the problem is that we read these headlines in the newspapers and go overboard and think, oh, they figured it out. And I think that we have to take it all with a grain of salt healthier.
We live in a culture where we hope that everything in principle is fixable.
And knowable.
And knowable.
And there is mystery. I mean, there really is mystery around food. And that's fine. And, you know, I was saying at some, I said at an event, I was in Iowa City, and I said, you know, the scientists will figure this out. At some point they will know what it is in a carrot, and they'll be able to make a meal in a pill. And someone came up to me after and said, you know, that's probably not true. That, you know, this assumption that it's just a matter of time before science answers every mystery, Is it outrageous hubris and conceit? Well, and in fact, you know, and one of my great teachers, Wendell Berry, has written
right,
about this
a great,
beautifully.
Wonderful writer.
Life is a Mystery is the title of a wonderful book he wrote trying to answer the scientists' overconfidence. And life may remain a mystery.
Well, there's a book, I forget the name of the author, came out recently, Canadian, called A Brief History of Progress, which has a double meaning. Saying that we solve a problem which then produces some other problem that we have to deal with later on.
That is very much the story of the food system. I mean, it's very interesting to watch. I mean, and this is. I mean, if you want to dwell on the negative, we have a food system that is creating patients, and we have a healthcare system that benefits from having lots of patients. And our focus as a society has not been on changing the way we eat. It has been on developing new drugs for diabetes, new drugs for heart disease, new procedures, you know, bariatric surgery. I mean, we have turned the public health crisis around food into a wonderful business opportunity for the healthcare industry. And they have much more interest in selling their fixes than in going back and addressing the systematic problem. And I think that that's the problem, because we are in a fork in the road. We either become the Lipitor nation. We become the country where on every street corner in the inner city there is a dialysis center next to the check cashing center, next to the fast food outlet, or we change the way we eat. And all the pressures of our economic system argue for the former solution. And that's the problem. And if we did have a national health care of some sort, and we could then connect the dots, and the government or whatever entity was paying the bills for our health care would understand that the way it could save money was changing the way people eat, and we would have public health campaigns around food the way we now do around smoking, which are very scary and very effective. And in fact, you see those in France, where the government has to pay for the health care. But right now, since we can outsource the problems created by the food industry to the healthcare industry, those dots are not being connected.
Yeah. Wanted to... last question is, what would you advise? Here's somebody comes to you and says, okay, I want to change. I want to change. Where do you...
Isn't this your line of work?
Listen, in my experience, people do not change willingly. Something... crisis or something brings them to that. I mean, you know, the questions would be, should I be a vegetarian? Should I, you know, those, I mean, really basic questions. You say don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. So you've got in your book some very good advice towards the end there. So
it's a very practical...
If you could give three or four things that you could say...
I mean, people change for a few reasons. People change because they have a crisis. And there are a great many, I know many parents who've had that conversation with their pediatrician, saying, this is the path your child is on. And unless you change the way he or she eats, diabetes lies in the future, and 80% risk of heart disease and all that kind of stuff. A very sobering conversation that often does bring around positive change. But there is another way, and that is, you know, to be led not by fear, but by pleasure. And the fact is that eating in this other way does not involve a sacrifice of pleasure. What it involves is a little more time and a little more money. In other words, it involves putting food a little closer to the center of your life and a higher priority amongst all the things, all the priorities you have for your time, all the claims on your time, all the claims on your paycheck. And I'm arguing that that's really what we need to do. In the most concrete sense, I try to give, you know, my advice is really simple. I mean, I give it away on the front of the book. I say, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Those seven words, basically, there's the whole message. Save your money on this book.
But when you say eat food, you're being particularly
focused. That's the hard part. You
know, to decide, well, what is food and what isn't?
That's where we need help, and that's why you do need to buy the book. Because because distinguishing between the food that we all should eat, that will keep us healthy, that people have been eating for a long time, and the edible food-like substances that have increasingly taken over the food supply and you know, assail you as you wheel through the supermarket, is difficult. So I try. That's why I offer those kind of algorithms, like, you know, don't eat anything your great grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. Think about it. When you pick up that box of Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes, would she recognize that as food? I venture to guess that she would not. She would not know how to administer that to her body. What is that thing?
Well, when I read that, I thought of my grandmother, a country woman who had 11 children, and one of the great treats, which would horrify people in California, one of the great treats was to have bread with dripping, beef dripping, poured all over it to eat. And I think of it now, it's absolutely delicious. And now I would feel I would have to do penance for 40 years.
Not if it was whole grain bread.
Oh. So, you see, the fat isn't the issue, it's the bread part. Okay, it would be whole grain bread.
You know, I had the same question, and I asked, there's a wonderful doctor in town who's got a terrific book coming out on traditional diets, Daphne Miller. I urge you to look for this book in June, I think it's coming out. And I was having lunch with her, and I said, now, I'm always telling people traditional diets are really a good way to go, and that any traditional diet is better than the Western diet, which most of us eat. And then I said, but people always ask me, well, what about your traditional diet, the diet of your ancestors? Well, Eastern European, Russian Jewish, you know, lots of, you know, cooking with chicken fat and duck fat and eating, you know, weird organs and lots of liver and things like
that's
that.
Right. Yeah.
And she said, well, why do you assume that is not a healthy diet? Those chickens that your ancestors were eating ran around outside and ate grass and bugs. And in fact, the fat of those chickens was full of very, you know, valuable nutrients and minerals, and the, you know, the fact that you were getting some of that, you know, and lots of omega-3s, and right. Yes, there was some saturated fat, but there were all these other things that came with it, and she refused to believe that was an unhealthy way to eat. And in fact, we're learning that if you are going to eat meat, and there's questions about, you know, how good an idea that is. One of the things we've stopped doing is eating organ meats, which is in fact where a great many of the you know, the benefits of meat come from. And if you look at traditional cultures, they eat the organ meats first, and those are the delicacies, because they have some basic understanding, you know, instinctual understanding that that's where you get all your vitamins and minerals, and it's true. Problem is, in modern industrial livestock, it's where toxins accumulate as well, and so the food is fundamentally different.
Yes,
than it was 100 years ago.
Well, we're going to open it up to the audience and people on the internet. That's right, you've got to raise your hand high. You've got to be patient. And if you make a speech, I'll try and cut you off on your knees, if possible. those of you who are listening on the internet, you can send your questions by clicking on your screen. Some of you may prefer to write out a question. So we have a question. Good.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here this morning. I am associated with CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, which is actually the largest purchaser of healthcare here in California. And I'm wondering, as a healthcare purchaser, what we're purchasing is medical care once someone is already ill. How can we actually influence our 1.2 million members who are in our healthcare system to improve how they eat and actually prevent themselves from getting ill? Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, it's a good question. One of the problems is the economic incentives in the healthcare system do not favor prevention, by and large. In certain HMOs, are designed to favor that. But right now, you know, there was an article in the Times last year about diabetes, or 2 years ago, that said that the economics of doing amputation is better than the economics of preventing a case of diabetes, which is amazing. And I don't understand exactly why that is. I don't know how you would do it, but we do reward people who take better care of their health with cheaper health care bills. For example, if you're a non-smoker, I mean, you get a certain advantage in terms of your health care and your insurance, life insurance as well. Is there some way to make that, you know, possible for people who take better care of their dietary health? I don't know how you would do that exactly, but it seems to me that it would be, you know, one thing worth exploring. But I think, you know, public education around food and diet is very, very important. The information, though, has been, it's very tame. largely because the government comes under incredible lobbying pressure every time it puts out a public health message about food. So, for example, when the low-fat message began, whatever you think of the low-fat message, it wasn't originally a low-fat message. Senator McGovern, when he was drafting the dietary goals, which was our first effort to educate the whole population on how to eat, he included a sentence, very straightforward, plain English, eat less red meat. And the industry came down on him, and there was a firestorm of criticism, and he was forced to revise it to say, choose meats that will lower your saturated fat intake. Very, very different statement, very confusing to most people, not about a food, about a nutrient. So we're hobbled in our ability to get out the public health message. And the budget and Marion Nestle, you should talk to her about this when she comes in May, and I urge you to come hear her, because she's very wise in the ways of not just nutrition science, but nutrition politics. Points out that the budget for the government's whole public health effort around food is the equivalent to the budget to market one junk food. It's a few million dollars. And we need to make that budget a lot bigger. But we also need to insulate those messages from the industry's ability to influence those messages. Right now, a lot of those messages come out of the Department of Agriculture. That's a tremendous mistake, because the Department of Agriculture has a conflict of interest. Their interest is in selling as much U.S. agricultural policy product as possible. So we need either the Surgeon General's office or some part of the government that is insulated from corporate influence that can put out a very strong health message around food. And people like you should be lobbying the government to do that message, because right now you're being drowned out by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which does not allow the government ever to say, eat less red meat.
Hi. Thank you for your insight. I heard an announcement today, or this week on NPR, that the FDA made an announcement that cloned animals, the dairy and meat from cloned animals was cleared, and that there was no difference between normal meat and dairy products. And I was just curious what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, this is true. The FDA has had this comment period about cloned animals, and they've decided they're okay. They're not about to enter the food supply yet, but they will at some point. There's no evidence, nobody's found any evidence that the meat or milk of these animals would be fundamentally different from others. I still see no reason to eat them, It's not in our interest to eat cloned animals. Are cloned animals going to be any cheaper or any tastier or any better? No. So there's some, unspecified risk and no benefit. So that argues for label it so I can choose not to eat it. They don't want to label it. Same as genetically modified food. They didn't want to label that too for the same reason. There was no benefit to us and there was some unspecified risk. I think the bigger problem with cloning animals and why it is just an incredibly foolish idea is that imagine a chicken house or a feedlot, a beef feedlot, with genetically identical animals in it. They would be so completely vulnerable to disease that you would need huge amounts of antibiotics to keep them alive. There's a reason we have sex. Actually, there's several reasons we have sex, but the one relevant in this context is that it leads to variation in a population. It allows us to evolve. The microbes are not going to stop. So if you stop evolution in your herd of cattle or your flock of chickens, and they're sitting ducks for the microbes that will continue to evolve until they can wipe out your cloned flock. So I think it's very foolish. And the risks, there was a wonderful article in the Chronicle today about antibiotic resistance and staph, although it underplayed the role that agriculture is having in this. But there is this community-acquired MRSA, antibiotic resistant staph infection, that's a tremendous problem in San Francisco, but elsewhere in the country as well, that in Europe and in Canada has been traced to pig confinement operations, where we're giving very similar antibiotics to the animals to keep them alive and breeding these lethal microbes. So 70% of the antibiotics we use are used in livestock raising, in agriculture. And this is a big problem. And this was predicted for years and years and years. You know, if we're so profligate in our use of antibiotics in livestock, you're going to have diseases that your antibiotics will no longer work on. And indeed, that chicken has come home to roost right now in San Francisco. So making the problem worse with lots of cloned animals seems to me like the height of folly.
We had a forums not long, a couple of years ago, on cloning with scientists and ethicists, and it was the scientists who were the most skeptical and nervous about saying that we just don't know what we're doing and the effects. And precisely as you said, when you have you eliminate that diversity, you then make them
diversity
more
is a tremendous biological kind of firewall. And we talk so much about efficiency in our country, in our economy, and the reason people wanted to clone animals and put them on feedlots is to maximize efficiency. But there is another value that is as, if not more important, and that is resiliency. And resiliency of a system comes from its diversity. And if you're going to have a kind of basic bias when you're looking at systems like this, efficiency, resiliency. Resiliency long term is much more important.
Great, good.
Dr. Dina Dell, who is a local radio personality here in San Francisco, has written a book called Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. And in the book, he says that if you do all the things that you hear about, eat a low-fat diet, eliminate red meat, don't consume alcohol, exercise regularly, and all of those things, you'll extend your lifespan by exactly 3 months.
I've heard those statistics. But of course, that's not the optimal program. It's the problem. We know now that people who are moderate drinkers live longer and have better health outcomes than people who don't drink at all. And we have reason to question that whole fat paradigm. Doing any of these things because you think you're going to live forever, which is fundamentally in the back of many people's heads, it's not, as Alan said, even the carrot eaters will die. That pleasure in eating is very, very important. And to ruin your pleasure in eating, to ruin such an important part of life in the interests of a illusion of life extension seems to me the height of folly also.
Yeah, I think this is where the spirituality issue comes in, is that we confuse pleasure with addiction sometimes. Mm. So that there's a whole question of, what we really do want and what does
give us
pleasure.
Different kinds of pleasure available to us. Fast food affords certain kinds of pleasure. Mm. They are engineered for a pleasurable first bite, very cleverly engineered, with the latest in food science. But this is a fleeting pleasure. Mm. This is the pleasure, as Wendell Berry says, of the one-night stand. There are deeper pleasures that come from knowing where your food comes from rather than ignorance about where your food comes from. Yeah. So there's pleasure and there's pleasure.
Deep pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sort of interested in the petroleum ingredient in this whole food discussion. Much of our world, certainly our urban world, is dependent on fertilizers and chemicals that are on the farms and the fuel to bring the food to our farm, to our homes, to our cities. What's going to happen? If you could put on your futuristic, goggles, what's going to happen in 200 years when the oil and natural gas are pretty much all gone for all intents and purposes? Are we all going to be returning to the farms? Are we all going to become gardeners and farmers so that we can be closer to our sustenance?
Well, it's a very good question. In my last book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, I dealt a lot with the fact that, the history of how we industrialized our food system. And one of the things you see is that the fundamental move in the industrialization of food was the replacement of solar energy with fossil fuel energy at every level of the system. And that, in fact, the way we eat, basically, it used to take, go back before 1900, for every 1 calorie of fossil fuel energy you put into the food system, remember calories are simply a unit of energy, for every 1 calorie of fossil fuel energy you put into the food system, you got back 2 calories of food energy. because you were still basically relying on the sun for your fertility and things like that. Now we're at a point, because of using petroleum-based fertilizers, petroleum-based pesticides, and moving the food all over the place and heavily processing it, it now takes 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy. So basically, we've taken this brilliant solar system, and remember, all food comes from photosynthesis. The sun feeds the plants, and the plants either feed us directly or they feed the animals we eat. And in the oceans, the sun feeds the algae, and the algae is the basis of the fish food chain. So we've taken the solar system, which is essentially nature's free lunch. It's the only free lunch in nature, is this energy coming in through plants to feed us. And we rejected that and put it on this basis of fossil fuel, which, as you say, will not last forever. The most profound change to the food system will come when the oil runs out, when we can't afford to do it this way. What will happen at that point is very hard to say. The challenge is that we preserve our ability to still make food from sunlight, which is to say, make it locally, make it using grass rather than grains that take lots of energy to grow. And that, you know, we just don't, when that moment comes, we don't want to look around and find that the Central Valley has been completely paved over, and that all the water has been allotted to development. But that is where we're going. Make no mistake in this state, that the water and the land will go to sprawl, and that the ability of California to grow its own food, not to mention grow food for much of the rest of the country, within 100 years is scheduled to be over. So preserving, again, the resiliency of the system, the ability to grow food near home, food that doesn't use a lot of fossil fuel, food that's grown with organic sources of fertility, is vitally important as we see this looming end of the fossil fuel economy.
In What to Eat, Marianne Nestle says generally she recommends eating organically grown vegetables over conventionally grown vegetables, which we can all get with. But then she also says that she prefers certified organic to what you in the Omnivore's Dilemma call beyond organic. Do you two actually disagree, or is it just a perspective issue?
I don't think it's a sizable disagreement. Certified organic is important in the marketplace because it is one of the few labels that's being carefully monitored by the government. So when you see something that's certified organic, you know that it doesn't have synthetic pesticides, you know it doesn't have synthetic sources of fertility or certain additives. It's not perfect, but it's got more teeth to it than a lot of other labels you see in the market. Beyond organic is a very vague term. There are people using it simply because they're not organic. But the reason I don't think organic is the last word in buying your food is because there are a lot of very good farmers who are organic who are no longer certified because they're selling in a farmer's market environment where they don't need to be, because the burden of paperwork of being organic is so high and the expense of it, and some people simply reject having the government in their business. Farmers are, you know, notoriously independent lot, and some of them don't like the idea of being audited by the government. So what I suggest is, I mean, the ideal situation is local and organic, and that's I think what we should strive for. But the question to ask someone when you go to the farmer's market is not, are you organic? Because they can't say they are if they're not, technically. They can't use that word. The question to ask is, how do you deal with insects on your farm? What's the source of fertility? And you may well find that even though they're not using that word, the way they're growing food is agreeable to you and meets your values. And that's why I'm saying, basically, just don't reject those people out of hand. They're not cheaters. They're not necessarily using pesticides, or they're using very small amounts of pesticides. There are great values to eating locally. One is to keep local farms going. One is to keep farmers in your community. One is to check sprawl. I mean, there's so many other values that, faced with a choice between getting certified organic produce from Chile or Mexico and getting local produce that may not be certified organic here, I usually vote for the local.
This will have to be our last question.
I'm married to a long-suffering vegetarian. I've not had the spiritual courage to make the leap yet myself. Seems like even in the enlightened Bay Area, being a vegetarian is like being a part of a puzzling minor religious sect. Just a word about vegetarianism, its future. There's obvious upsides. Are there downsides?
Well, I am not a vegetarian either. But I have enormous admiration for vegetarians. And the reason for that is that they have thought through the consequences of their food choices. They've looked at it from a moral point of view, an ethical point of view, a spiritual point of view, and decided what to do rather than simply being the passive victims of a system telling them what to eat. So they've done the work that we all need to do. And I did that work also and just came out at another place, which is to say supporting a very narrow segment of the meat industry, people growing meat sustainably, humanely. I think there is a place. I think that, and I make an environmental argument for eating meat grown under these conditions, in that a sustainable agriculture needs animals to cycle nutrients. There are many places where to eat locally, meat is the most sustainable way to take protein off of the land, where places you can't grow row crops. I came from New England, so I was particularly attuned to the fact that milk and meat were really the things that could be grown well in my town. From a health point of view, vegetarians are, you know, they have excellent health outcomes. They live longer than the rest of us, and they have lower rates of heart disease, so it's a very healthy way to eat. A couple provisos I would add to that. One is that flexitarians, as they're called, people who eat small amounts of meat, who treat meat as a flavoring or something they eat a couple times a week, are just as healthy as those vegetarians. It's the people eating meat three times a day that really get into trouble. And the other point is, you can be a vegetarian and eat tons of junk food. I mean, there's, you know, yeah. It's possible to have a plant-based diet based on processed junk. And so that, you know, just because you're a vegetarian, you know, you can't go eat those Twinkies. Although, actually, the Twinkies do have some beef byproducts in them.
Right.
So I'm kind of, you know, I think, again, going back to this Manichaean idea, I'm not kind of an all-or-nothing person. I mean, I defend a very narrow kind of meat, animal protein eating.
But you do say mostly plants.
I do say mostly plants, but I do say mostly, because I think that extremism in pursuit of eating is dangerous all around. Yeah. And meat, you know, from a nutritional point of view, there is no good reason that I've found to completely exclude meat from your diet. I kind of hold with Thomas Jefferson, who said we should treat meat as a condiment for the vegetables. I think that's a very sane view.
You're very much in tune with what we struggle here in this culture. We have a... As I often say here, we have a passion for moderation, and that's very, very hard to get across to people. I think
unpopular position.
You also raise the question, I think, beautifully, the underlying question of how to be fully and profoundly human, what it is to be human in a human family, and how we treat each other and how we treat the environment is all part of that picture. So. Next week we have the former presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold, who we're going to just talk about what's going on in religion and in the church. I want to thank you for coming. We rely on your support for these forums, so please make a gift of whatever you can afford as you leave today. And our webcast listeners can click the Support Us link on the top of the screen. Marion Nessel will be coming later on in the spring, and you can check our website for her visit. Grace Cathedral is proud to be known as a house of prayer for all people without exception, and we continue with our liturgy at 11 o'clock upstairs if you can join us. I want to thank you, Michael. What a great guest you've been for joining us this morning. I hope that you'll be able to stay and maybe sign your books.
I would be happy.
If you haven't read Michael Pollan, he's an engaging writer and saying some important things. So please stay behind and say hello to Michael. And so thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was really great.
Really, thank you.
Lovely. You're a lovely man.